The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear me, hear you. All persons on business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals brought here. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Sergeant Workneff, ACM number 38928. Appellant presents one issue for our consideration today. It is whether the military judge abused his discretion when he accepted appellant's guilty plea to bank fraud under Title 18 U.S.C. 1344 subsection 2 without establishing the appellant made a false or fraudulent representation or promise or used false or fraudulent pretenses to effect the alleged crime. Mr. Cipriano, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes, very well. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kirk Cipriano, and I, along with Captain Clary, represent the appellant, Sergeant Workneff. Sergeant Workneff respectfully requests this court set aside his conviction for bank fraud for two reasons. First, there was not, and there could not be, a material misrepresentation here in light of the appellant's actual authority to take the actions he took. And second, even if this court believes there was a material misrepresentation, the military judge still abused his discretion when he failed to inquire into the potential effect that the appellant's actual authority had here on the actions he took in question with respect to the bank fraud conviction. As the government has noted in its brief, there is really no question that the appellant had the authority to write and cash the checks here. So the question before the court essentially is a purely legal question, the question of whether or not someone who has lawful authority to access an account can be convicted of bank fraud when he exercises that authority. Since it's a purely legal question, a de novo review is appropriate, and the appellant believes the answer to that question is no.
Before you get too far into it, Do you agree or you concede that the elements of bank fraud that were provided to your client and the definitions of bank fraud that were provided to your client were accurate?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that affects whether or not he was given the actual elements. It doesn't affect, obviously, the materiality. The materiality of the actual actions in question was a question of law for the military judge to determine, obviously, for this court to affirm. Now, in looking at the record, the material misrepresentation that the appellant pointed to at his trial was this memorandum. But that memorandum, if you look at it, Your Honors, there is no misrepresentation in those memoranda at all. In fact, it says specifically, the subject's request for emergency cash, and then there's one sentence that says the deputy disbursing officer is asking for whatever the particular amount of money is in each occasion for emergency cash. Now, those are just factual things. I mean, he was the deputy disbursing officer, and these are not a misrepresentation. This is a evidence of his misuse of his authority. Now, as a deputy disbursing officer, he handled certain accounts for the wing. One of the things he apparently handled was the emergency cash available to the wing, and in his discretion, by virtue of the fact that he wrote these memos, it's clear that he had the discretion to request more emergency cash whenever he wanted to, and that's exactly what he did. So it's merely a request for the emergency cash, and it is an exercise of his authority as the dispersing officer, and his discretion, the deputy dispersing officer, an exercise of his discretion. Now, that exercise of discretion may have been wrong, but that doesn't convert it to a misrepresentation. What he does is then he takes that exercise, gets the cash, and then takes the cash. Well, there's a name for that crime, and it's embezzlement. This is exactly what he did. It is not, and so as a factual matter, when you look at the facts, there was no material misrepresentation made by the appellant with respect to those memoranda. Now,
counsel, this is a guilty plea. This is not a legal sufficiency case. That's not what's raised before the court. This was a guilty plea to where your client came in and provided the judge with factual matters that he believed supported his plea. Now, it's up to the judge to decide whether or not, in fact, that did support the plea. What facts, I guess, are out there that show that memorandum was not a material representation or false material representation to the bank?
Well, as a legal matter, for it to be a material misrepresentation, as the Supreme Court has said in Nieder, it must be something that it inspires, the right word, but it, It makes the decision-making body act. In this particular case, those memoranda are not the issue. They're not what's making the bank give the money over. It's the check.
And where do we have evidence that the memorandum did not help effectuate him receiving the money? Where in the record does it say that, that it was irrelevant to him receiving the money?
Well, that is the implication of the fact that he has the authority to write the checks. I mean, the government and all the parties stipulated that he is writing lawful checks that are real checks that need to be honored by the bank and by the U.S. government. I mean, that's directly within the stipulation of fact. You can come to the conclusion that the memoranda are not what's inducing the bank to pay out the money by taking the checks out of the equation. Just respectfully, if you imagine that he shows up with the guards and with the bags to take the money, and he has a memoranda that says, hey, Armed Forces Bank, I am the deputy dispersing officer. I would like $42,000. The bank will look at him and say, that's nice. I would like you to hand me a treasury check that is made out so that I can cash and pay out this money. So it is clear, there is no case of bank fraud that appellant could find wherein a person was convicted of bank fraud for exercising authority that was granted to him and exercising discretion that was granted to him with respect to accounts he had access to. So there, all of those cases and all of the bank fraud cases, there are some, for example, Loughran is a con man who is dressing up as a Mormon, stealing checks, and he's passing them off to Target. And Justice Kagan specifically says that it is the false fraudulent check, which is what induces the payment or the provision of goods by Target and the subsequent payment of that check by the bank. So there isn't any case where that says somebody with authority can be convicted of bank fraud. There just hasn't been an exemplar case of that. That's why this is a question of law, not specifically just a question of the plea. You know, so there's a separate issue here. I mean, as the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has said, when there's a legal question, de novo review is appropriate based on the fact that this court can review the facts and look at them and determine whether or not you can, as a legal matter, convict somebody of bank fraud when they have the authority to access the accounts they have for writing checks that they're authorized to write.
But that's not what the appellant said in this case. That's not what he informed the military judge. Would you agree with that?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. So that speaks to a very important but subtle point. And as the panel is well aware, the Carey inquiry, it has two functions. It has a function of determining that the judge always tells the defendant, I will not accept your plea of guilty unless you actually believe you are guilty, and then if the facts support the finding of guilt. So there's two pieces of that. So him saying, for example, that in this case he said, well, he believes it is the memoranda that make them pay out. Okay, so he does say that. But that is relevant only to the first prong of the Carey inquiry. In other words, that satisfies the fact that he believes he's guilty, but the military judge still has, and this court still has, the duty to make sure that the facts that were provided at the court-martial can support that finding of guilt. And that's not the case where he has the authority here. So, for example, let's say, another brief, just really brief hypothetical, I'll say, imagine that he said, well, you know, what's the material misrepresentation? He said, well, I told them I could do 200 push-ups, and I'm pretty sure they gave me the money because, you know, I was so physically fit, but in fact, I can only do 25 push-ups. Well, that wouldn't be sufficient. That would not be a material misrepresentation. The judge would not be bound to the legal conclusion that that was material misrepresentation any more than this court would be. In fact, it would be error for the judge to to find him guilty based on that if that was the only evidence of a material misrepresentation.
But the evidence of material misrepresentation in this case was that he needed the money for an official purpose, which he admitted to the judge was not the reason why he submitted the memorandum in the first place. It was not for an official purpose. It was for his own personal use.
So there's two pieces to that as well. So the first part is that his submission of the memoranda was totally within his authority as the deputy dispersing officer. So the appellant at that point was conflating those issues. You know, he was concealing the fact that he was going to take the money later on, but in fact, all he did was ask for emergency funds. And now emergency funds are just a class of money that the wing holds on hand for the purposes of paying out when an emergency arises. In other words, they contemplate being used at a later date. His asking for that was a discretionary decision. As a deputy dispersing officer, one of the things he managed was emergency cash. And he says, in my opinion, there's not enough emergency cash. I'm going to get more. Now,
that's not what he stated. I mean, he informed the judge there was no requirement for emergency cash because there wasn't a paying agent mission during those periods of time. So he informed the judge, would you agree, that there was no official reason for him to request the money at that point?
Correct, Your Honor. And that demonstrates how it was an abuse of his discretion. So he makes a decision. He looks at the cash, and there's no paying agent mission. There's no reason for it, but he still says, look, I'm going to get emergency cash. Why? So later I can steal it. But that's still an exercise of his discretion, and it may have been an incorrect or abuse of his discretion, but that's exactly what makes it an embezzlement, not a bank fraud. I mean, he has the authority to do this. He actually does take the money, and he puts it in the safe. It's only at a later date that he takes it and converts it to his own use. This is really a question of the parties down below who are trying to shoehorn in the facts into the elements of bank fraud when it's undeniable that the facts meet the elements of embezzlement much cleaner and correctly, someone with authority to use and exercise the authority to cash checks from this account converts it to his own personal use. That crime is embezzlement, Your Honor. This was, in fact, harmful to appellant's case. I mean, I think that when we look at this, if I could rewind just very quickly, even if this court feels that there was a material misrepresentation, the other point is that the military judge should have examined more deeply the appellant's authority and its effect on his plea of guilty to bank fraud. In other words, he should have said, are you sure that you have the ability to cash these checks? It's not like he's impersonating someone. If he had gone and impersonated some other wing's disbursing officer and cash check, that would be bank fraud. But he wasn't impersonating anyone. It was his actual authority that was causing the bank to pay out. The military judge should have examined that. The Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has stated that the plea colloquy and the care inquiry is supposed to be an interactive discussion between the judge and the appellant for the purposes of determining the legal liability for any crime that he's pleading guilty to. So if you consider that someone had told him that, this is something that really fits the definition of embezzlement. They're trying to plead you guilty to bank fraud. Embezzlement is 10 years. Bank fraud is 30 years of potential confinement. It is not really conceivable that any defendant in that situation would make a decision other than to choose to try and renegotiate a plea to embezzlement vice bank fraud, specifically for the purposes of limiting his exposure to confinement. So this is an error that directly affected his rights and affected his case.
Counsel, I'll ask you a question about the memoranda requesting emergency cash. As you look at that document, is your position that there's any representation at all in that document? Is there anything being communicated or asserted?
I think the only thing that he's asserting is that he is the deputy disbursing officer, which is correct, and he's making a request for emergency cash.
So with use of the terminology emergency cash, used a couple times here, does that imply that there is, in fact, some kind of urgency or emergency that the Air Force has with regards to getting this cash?
My understanding is that the emergency cash was kept in the safe for the purposes paying out emergencies that arise. In other words, I think the only potential implication, and it's not that there's an emergency, but that he, the deputy's personal officer, has evaluated in his discretion how much emergency cash is on hand, and in his discretion he's determined that there is not enough, therefore he should ask for more. But that is all, again, within his discretionary ability as the manager of those accounts and the manager of the emergency cash account.
All right. So you're saying it's more or less his assessment or his opinion about sufficiency of cash.
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah, I think that if he was saying that there was an emergency, he would say, I request $42,000 for an emergency. I mean, there's a difference, and I know that language there is subtle, but there's a difference. I mean, he as a disbursing officer was managing his cash flow. Now, we know that in the end he wanted that cash, and he put it in the safe and took it later. But that, again, that's embezzlement, a crime for which the punishment is a third of the crime of bank fraud.
So you've noted that as a disbursing officer, you've got the authority to go ahead and sign the check, present the check to the bank. And that authority is necessary to get the cash from the bank for these accounts. But the role of the memoranda, what did that play? You know, why was it even present in the scenario here at all?
I mean, I think that it plays the same role as the fact that he physically traveled to the bank to get the money. I mean, I think that it was part of, and he was accessing the money as part of his exercise of his authority as a dispersing officer. You know, I think it's nothing more than a but-for causation. I know the government has sort of said that in that stipulation where he says in order to affect this scheme, or I forget exactly how the government argued it, but there's language in there that says in order to affect the scheme, he wrote memoranda. But that's a determination of materiality that shouldn't be in the stipulation of fact. You know, I think that the role it plays is nothing more than mere but-for causation in the sense that it was something that he did to get the cash. It's not something that induced, that's separate from whether it's something that induced the bank to give him the cash. Again, it wouldn't be sufficient if he showed up with just that memoranda. I mean, what makes the bank want to pay is that there is a check written on the United States Treasury's credit, which is, the best credit in the world.
So for your argument to hold about the lack of materiality, these memos would have had to have no influence whatsoever on the bank as they went through the process of cashing the checks. Isn't that right?
Well, I don't think it's quite that distinct. I mean, it can't be. So the issue is, it must be what's, and this is the Supreme Court saying, it has to be what's inducing the bank to make the payment. So every but-for causation, I think, is not, you know, it's legally material is the question. And I don't think it's legally material. You know, I think
it's a natural tendency to influence or capable of influencing a decision maker, correct? So it wouldn't have to be dispositive, just something that added to the mix of saying, yes, this appears legitimate, I'm going to go ahead and cash this check. Isn't that correct?
I disagree with that interpretation of the case law. And I think it is very clear that it has to be something that is inducing in order to be material. Otherwise, everything would, you know, the fact that he's from the Air Force would be something that would be potentially inducing the bank. I mean, it is just like but-for causation versus legal approximate causation. I think that's the issue here. So, obviously, if you feel if the court decides that that it is, you know, merely the anything that has an influence, then, you know, I think that you still have to go to that question of whether or not he explored the authority and the potential authority and its impact on a plea of bank fraud with Stashar and Werkna sufficiently to assure this court that he believed he was guilty of bank fraud, vice embezzlement, that he understood the legal situation here. I mean, so there's still two pieces to that. I think there's a purely legal question. The correct answer is that the memoranda did not have any real relevance here. I mean, again, I think you could take it out.
But that's rooted in your argument that if someone has the legal authority, that's all that's necessary. Nothing else is really relevant at that point, correct?
Yeah, I think that's essentially.
The question I would have then is it possible for a dispersing officer with authority vis-a-vis some accounts to ever commit bank fraud vis-a-vis those accounts?
I don't think so. I mean, and it's not a hole in the law. I mean, there's 18 U.S.C. 853 specifically talks about dispersing officer misusing public funds. So it's not something that Congress has, excuse me, it's not something Congress has not thought about and not addressed. I mean, I think that's correct. Somebody who is, I mean, fraud is the act of holding yourself out to be something you're not. If you are that thing that has the authority, you're not fraudulently holding yourself out when you exercise that authority. So I think that's correct. I don't think it is a hole in the state of the federal statutes. I think that the federal statute of embezzlement, the dispersing officer misusing public funds crime addresses this quite clearly. So, in summation, there are two issues. There's a legal error here. It is subject to de novo review, the question being whether or not somebody with the authority to access accounts can be punished or charged with and convicted of bank fraud for exercising that authority. And then there's a second potential abuse of discretion if you find that the answer to that legal question is yes. And that's the sufficiency with which the military judge looked at and investigated the appellant's inherent authority, as a deputy dispersing officer, and whether or not he adequately understood and knowingly and intelligently made a plea of guilt to that. It affected his sentence, obviously, I think, by virtue of the difference in overall maximum punishment. And the appellant respectfully requests that this court set aside the finding of guilt in this case.
I want to double back real quick.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just to the memo issue again. Do you agree that the appellant, in admitting the elements to the military judge, basically stated that the memorandum was material, and it was material because they wouldn't have provided him the money if he had listed on there for gambling, or I want to buy a boat, or I need a car, or whatever the issue may have been. What within what he admitted to did not meet the elements of the offense? I understand your argument that the judge should have realized that because he had the authority as a dispersing officer, there's a conflict and he should have inquired on that. But what within that appellant informed the military judge did not meet all of the elements of the offense?
Yeah, I think that you're correct, Your Honor, that I think he spit out all the elements of the offense by saying, as a factual matter, that he believed it. Now, that doesn't obviously, the legal issues we just talked about all still stand, but I think that he did stand up and say, you know, this was the misrepresentation and they wouldn't have given me the money.
Then we really look at is there something else in there that's patently inconsistent with what the appellant informed the judge, either through the care inquiry and through the stip of facts? So what other than the fact that one of the paragraphs in the stipulation of facts said he had the ability to, as a dispersing officer, to cut checks, is there anything else other than that one specific paragraph that you're arguing supports that patent inconsistency with what the appellant informed the judge?
Yeah, I think it's at page 69 of the record he specifically talks about, and the government points this out in its brief on page 7 of its brief. It says he repeatedly talked about how he had the authority to take these actions as a deputy dispersing officer. So that is the patent inconsistency which the military judge should have explored, and maybe they would have found this issue, the fact that he was really guilty of embezzlement, vice bank fraud at that point. I mean, he specifically says that, you know, he has the authority to take these actions. So,
because of his official position, but he also informed the judge that he was not acting in his official position when he took money out for personal use. Would you agree with that?
I agree, but I think that's the inconsistency, Your Honor. I mean, he's saying that he has the authority, and he's also saying he's not using his authority correctly. Well, maybe that can resolve the issue for the judge if the judge specifically asks and says, well, what were the limits of your authority? That, again, that's not something that they ever got into. It's not clear from the record what the limits of his authority are. It appears to be that, you know, his authority was unlimited with respect to the discretion for cashing and writing these checks. So that is essentially what the military judge should have gone over with him and said, hey, you said you had this authority. Where did it end? How do you know it ended? Why is that? You know, and then if he said it was unlimited, maybe they start talking about embezzlement, vice bank fraud, and he rejects the plea of guilty, and they come back. The trial counsel, defense counsel, put their heads together, and they come back with a plea to the proper crime. If there are no further questions.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Captain Musselman, the government may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Tyler Musselman. Myself, along with Colonel Catherine Oler, represent the United States in this proceeding. During his care inquiry, appellant admitted, I did not have an official purpose for retrieving the monies from the Armed Forces Bank on these occasions. According to the stipulation of fact, when he presented the cashier's check and received the money, the accused's actions were not conducted pursuant to a legitimate law enforcement activity, nor done by any authorized means in the performance of his official duties. This fact, along with many others in the record, uphold the military judge's decision to accept appellant's plea to bank fraud under the specification of charge 3 in this case. Now, before going into detail of the record and how it supports the military judge's determination, it's important to look at the context and the standard of review. This case is not reviewed de novo. It's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. Whether or not the misrepresentation is material is not a legal question. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Nader, N-E-D-E-R, the Supreme Court specifically held that such determination goes to the trier of fact. It is a question of fact. That is why it appears in the elements in this case. If you look at the elements as read by the military judge, it includes a material representation, and then he defines material. That is a question of fact to be determined by the fact finder. Really, appellant's argument boils down to, as he initially briefed this court, whether or not there was a sufficient factual predicate for the military judge's decision. In other words, did the judge get out enough facts to determine that there was a material misrepresentation? That's not de novo. It's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. It's important to consider what else our Superior Court has said in circumstances where an appellant is challenging the judge's decision to accept a plea on whether or not there was a factual predicate basis. According to CAF, this is an area that courts give the military judge significant deference. Courts should give broad discretion to military judges in accepting pleas as the facts are undeveloped. Now, to continue on, judges' acceptance of a plea will not be overturned on the mere possibility of a defense, and a court will not speculate as to the existence of facts which might invalidate a plea. So no maybes or could have or might have been. So this is the lens and the narrow view which this court should review the military judge's decision.
But counsel, we do look at there's an inconsistency with those facts. That is something that we can inquire into. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the basis for a military judge to abuse his discretion is whether there's a substantial inconsistency that raises a substantial question in law or fact to the providency of the plea.
And okay, so, and then looking at least appellant's argument that there were at least facts in the stipulation of fact, and there were facts raised during the CARE inquiry that the appellant had the inherent authority to cut and cash checks for emergency funds. Taking that with the appellant's then comment that basically there was a material misrepresentation, how is that not a conflict that at least reasonably raised the issue of whether or not there may have been a defense to this charge, or probably more consistent would be whether or not there were facts raised that were inconsistent with his plea?
Senior Judge Zabriskie, that's a great question, and the answer is the United States disagrees that the appellant had the authority to engage in the conduct he did. I think that there needs to be a differentiation between ability and authority. The ruse here was that he was showing up in his official position. That is the fraud, right? That's the cloak. The misrepresentation is that he was acting pursuant to an official Air Force purpose, that he had the authority to do what he did. If you look through the record, it is full of the military judge didn't abuse discretion, because if you look, you have comments in the CARE inquiry like, I did not have an official purpose for retrieving the money from the Armed Forces Bank. The accused actions were not done conducted pursuant to any law enforcement activity, nor done by any authorized means in the performance of financial duties. So there is no inconsistency. It's this difference between authority and ability. And if you look at the United States brief, it talks about using his official position. By using, we mean abusing, right? That's the ruse. He's under this cloak of his official position, but the reality is he didn't have authority to get this emergency cash. It's admitted in the CARE inquiry throughout the stipulation.
Well, but in paragraph 2 of the stipulation of fact, it says the accused had the ability to access and withdraw funds held by the 60th Air Mobility Wing by printing and authenticating treasury checks and cashing those checks at the Armed Forces Bank located at Travis Air Force Base, California. So it says flat out there, it doesn't say anything about a memorandum. It just says he had that authority to do it. Now, granted, the government maybe could have been clearer in how they drafted the stipulation of fact, but that's on the government, not on the appellant at this point in time.
Well, sir, it says ability, not authority. And that goes back to my point that if he was a maintenance troop and showed up with a treasury check, the ruse isn't going to work. It's the ability, right? That's what made the misrepresentation work, is that in his official position, when he has the authority to, he has this authority to pass these checks. And so it's one of those things where it's the difference between ability and authority. The ability there, and I think actually it's captured in the stipulation, and this would be at page 4, paragraph 16. While the appellant received money through his role as the deputy disbursing officer, so this is, you know, this is the guise, he received it through his role, he abused his position and made false representations in the form of both the purpose of the treasury checks and the memoranda to obtain them. That's the distinction here, is that the authority doesn't exist. If you read through the stipulation of fact in the CARE inquiry, he printed these checks himself, he printed the memoranda out himself. There is nothing but facts in the record that said that he had no proper Air Force mission or purpose to be doing that, and that this was outside the scope of his authority. When you look at it that way, and once again, you're looking at the military judge's decision for an abuse of discretion here, right? Because if you're in this vein, you're looking at whether or not there was an inconsistency that needed to be resolved. And given this ability versus authority distinction, over and over, appellant asserting that he did not have the authority, did not have proper purpose. Once again, we're not to speculate as to whether or not a defense existed. All the information here supports the judge's decision. Whether or not maybe the language could have been better, maybe that would have been a question the judge could have delved into, but that's not the standard we're looking at here when it's a guilty plea, especially when you talk about were these knowing and intelligent admissions. Here, this isn't a one-year airman. This is an NCO. He just passed a staff sergeant test the first time, top five. He understood his authority. He'd received multiple awards throughout his career in finance. He understood his position. He understood his authority. That's why you have these statements in the stipulation of fact, that this was all outside the bounds of his authority.
So, counsel, let me ask you with precision now, what are the false representations that underlie this guilty plea?
Your Honor, I think the false representation here is that he was acting pursuant to proper Air Force authority, that he had the authority to withdraw this money. And
so, counsel, that's not written down any place. That's just arguing that's just implicit with him even walking over there and presenting these checks, given the fact that it wasn't for an official purpose. Was that the false representation, or at least a false representation?
Sure, yeah, and I think he walked up and presented this information to the bank teller that he was entitled to these funds in his official position. The embodiment of that misrepresentation you see most clearly in the memoranda.
Let me ask you this. In the absence of memoranda, if that wasn't part of the case and all he did was show up with the check, you know, filled out, made out to himself, and presented those, would you still be arguing there was a false representation?
Yes. And there's other things that go into it. It's not just the memorandum. You'll see in the stipulation at least once he had a police escort. The check itself says pay to the order of appellant and underneath his duty title. So once again, he's putting forth this assertion that he's acting in his official Air Force capacity.
But what is being misrepresented on the face of that check? I mean, there's something that's there, obvious, or is there something, some other theory here? Are you referring to some kind of deliberate concealment at this point? If that's a theory.
They sort of bleed together, sir. And I'll talk about concealment a little bit. But I think that by handing over the check, all these things, the misrepresentation is that he wasn't acting in his official purpose. And the check in combination with the police escort, he was doing this during duty hours, it was clear. You can clean that from the stipulation fact. All of that is our representations that he's doing this pursuant to his Air Force authority as dispersing officer, which he was not. And so even without the memorandum, you don't get there. Of course, we have the memorandum in this case. Appellant clearly stating, if not for they wouldn't have given me the money had they known it was for gambling. I mean, right, so that kind of ties you to the materiality and the representation as a whole. Had they known his true purpose for withdrawing the money, they would not have given him, and that's the representation, right? The representation that I'm getting this pursuant to a proper Air Force purpose, emergency cash specifically, according to the memorandum. But even without it, I think you have enough there to find it, which we don't need to. Appellant himself, in the apology note he left for his commander before he went AWOL to Ethiopia, stated, I want to apologize to Marie at the Armed Forces Bank and everyone else that works there. Sorry I told you that the money was needed for paying agent mission when it was not. This is before a judge ever talked to him in a care inquiry. This is his own writing. It's Attachment 13, Prosecution Exhibit 1, which is the STIP. This is a clear indication that the appellant knew that he made misrepresentations at the bank and they had a role in him withdrawing this money. So I think, you know, him showing up in an official position even without the memoranda. But we don't have to worry about that in this case because we have the memoranda. And just a note, clearly they were critical to each transaction. He handed a memoranda in every time he submitted a check, all six times, all six are in the stipulation. And then you have, of course, the care inquiry where he states, yes, it was material. They would not have given me the money without the memoranda. And then, as I already stated, you have the checks themselves. You also have the police escort and appeared to be in during the duty day. These are all misrepresentations that he's doing this pursuant to his authority, which between the STIP and the care inquiry clearly did not. And given that evidence that's in there, there is no inconsistency there. It's ability versus authority. The ability is the ruse. It's the I am actually in my Air Force position. That's why they gave him the money. But that was also the misrepresentation. I said I was going to talk a little bit about concealment, too, Judge Harding, to answer your question. The parties briefed and cited Colton. One thing I'd like to make clear is that case was a 1344 prong one. That's one thing that was not in our brief. And so it was under a different prong. And it talks about sort of common law definitions of defraud, because under prong one you have defraud. And here we're prong two. So the court should take that into consideration. But I think the principles are at play still. You hear appellant concede that the elements as well as the definitions are accurate. Within those, you have concealment. And so appellant was instructed on concealment and that a misrepresentation can be a concealment of material facts.
Did the military judge really inquire at all whether or not there was a concealment type theory?
Well, I would say that given the definition, whenever he was discussing misrepresentation, the court could consider that as a concealment as well. And so those definitions are false representation. They include actual direct false statements as well as half-truths and the knowing concealment of material facts.
And I understand he properly instructed the appellant on the elements which covered that. Just as far as what the appellant admitted during the care inquiry and what the judge inquired into, was there any discussion with regard to this, hey, it was your official duty, therefore, regardless of the memo? I mean, there wasn't really a discussion on the record to support a guilty plea to the concealment, or does the government argue there was?
I believe there is, Your Honor. I think the distinction is between having a duty to disclose something and what, for instance, the court in Colton identified as active concealment. And so even if for some reason the court didn't find that the memorandum was an assertion, and I think we're kind of beyond that at that point, you have active steps to conceal the fact that he was going to use this money for gambling. Harken back to printing out the check under his official titles, showing up in police escort, doing this during duty hours in the memoranda itself. I mean, really, I don't think at this point we even need to go towards concealment. It is an alternative government argument. And I would say that whenever the judge was discussing material misrepresentations or misrepresentations, the definition of that includes concealment. I don't think it's an alternative.
But concealment wasn't inquired into. And I guess that's my question is, you know, on guilty plea cases, if we find the plea is improvident, but there's release admissions to a lesser included offense, we can go there. I guess I'm seeking on, if the judge accepted it under a certain theory, how are we as a court going to go back now and basically uphold a guilty plea under another theory, another definition that was not inquired into by the judge, facts were not developed by the appellant, or whether it be through the STIP or the care inquiry? So I guess that's what I'm struggling with now, on how the court would then go ahead and affirm a guilty plea when there was really no inquiry into those specific facts supporting that kind of theory of the crime.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I think what you have is the difference between an alternative theory, and so that's why the argument is that it's not an alternative theory because you're still under a misrepresentation. It's just that one of the things a misrepresentation can be is active concealment, and I think that there's enough on the record for that. For instance, I don't think we could get up here and argue that prong one was in play here because the judge didn't go into prong one. To me, that's an alternative theory and distinguishable. But once again, this concealment argument, Your Honor, is an alternative one that really I don't even think we need to get to because you have the memorandum, you have assertions. You could see it at the last paragraph of even his apology note where he's clearly acknowledging his deceit to the tellers. Now, to address some of Pellett's arguments, as far as whether or not the crime constitutes embezzlement or is, frankly, the United States argues irrelevant to the question here. If the crime meets the elements of the offense, the military judge didn't abuse his discretion that ends the inquiry. Whether he could have been charged with an alternative or an additional crime, I don't think matters to this court's analysis. You see that in a couple of sites United States provided at the Graham. One of the things that was brought up in briefs that wasn't really talked about today is whether the bank was obligated to cash the check. In other words, that even if the appellant had told them it was for gambling, they would still have to cash the check because he showed up under the guise of deputy disbursing officer. That's not contained. The United States would disagree if that's the current characterization of the facts. I think that argument may stem from page 4, paragraph 15 of the STIP. That doesn't say anything about the Armed Forces Bank being required to honor the checks if appellant told them about, hey, I'm going to use this for gambling. That just talks about the Air Force is required to pay the checks that were cashed when somebody with the ability, apparent ability, goes up and cashes the check. It's talking about the Air Force, not the Armed Forces Bank. And when you look at the purpose of that paragraph, it's obviously talking about how the Air Force is the victim because it had to reimburse the funds. And so that's kind of a factual distinction the United States would like to point out. Already talked a little bit about the knowing and intelligence parts of his pleas. Once again, he stated there was no paying agent mission, which would have required the emergency cash. The money was not intended for that purpose. I had no lawful purpose for doing this. I knew it was wrong each time, yet I returned for more money once I lost it. While he received the money through his role, right, that's a misrepresentation, he abused his position. So taking all that into account, what we have is whether or not the military judge abused his discretion, given the significant deference that comes when you're talking about whether or not he extracted enough facts to substantiate the pleas. There's no inconsistency here between, his authority allowed him to do this, and the military judge was not required to read into that. So therefore, this court should uphold the military judge's decision. Now, for a few moments, I'd like to talk a little bit about what relief if this court were to set aside this specification. Appellant has asked for a sentencing rehearing or an alternative reduction in the sentence, I believe, to 2 years in a dishonorable discharge. Under the Winkleman factors, the United States contends a rehearing would not be necessary. Understanding that the minimum punishment or maximum punishment for confinement would reduce substantially, that's just one of the factors. That doesn't per se mean that the court cannot readjust the sentence. You look at whether or not this was members and judge alone. It's a judge alone sentence. That is that swings in favor of reassessment. Whether the remaining offenses capture the gravamen, what's really offensive, what mad about here. With the larceny and the AWOL specification, you have theft of $420,000 worth of Air Force money, and you have using it to gamble, going on 2 and 3 day gambling binges, and you have somebody that left the country and fled and went AWOL. What really mad about here is that money. That money includes the money that appellant withdrew through the Treasury checks. So the gravamen of the offense is all of it's still there. And then, of course, whether the remaining offenses are the type that this court typically sees. Granted, these are extreme examples, AWOL to a different country and larceny of $420,000 worth of Air Force money. It's still larceny and AWOL, and this court can fashion sentence appropriate. The United States would contend that the sentence should be the same that's adjudged and approved by the convening authority. Also taking into account issue 3 that was raised and obviously not argued here. And the reason for that is you have the gravamen that's still in play. The United States would contend that the facts and circumstances of his conduct at the bank would still have been admissible in sentencing. And just like you have the back end of the gambling, you would have the front end and how he got access to the money. And so it's for those reasons that reassessment would just go to the judge and approve sentence. Subject to this court's questions, briefly conclude.
Please.
Appellant admitted under oath that he made a material misrepresentation of the Armed Forces Bank, that he did not have the authority, either legally or under his position, to do what he did. The bank would not have provided the money had they known the true purpose for his withdrawal. Recognizing that a military judge's discretion to accept a plea on a factual basis is given significant deference, This court should hold that the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he accepted appellant's voluntary, knowing, and intelligent plea to bank fraud under the specification of charge. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cipriano, a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, I think that
the government's distinction here between ability and authority is a distinction without a difference. I mean, the real fact of the matter is if you accept their characterization of what happened here as a misrepresentation of his power, then essentially every embezzlement becomes a bank fraud. And that's clearly not the intention of Congress. There is a difference here, and there is a difference with respect to his exercise of authority. I mean, he exercised his actual authority. These were real checks. There's nothing in the record that cabins his authority or limits his authority to write these checks or limits his discretion. And accordingly, we believe that the conviction for bank fraud is erroneous and should be set aside.
But he did say that the checks would not have been cashed had it not been for the memo that was provided to the bank.
Again, and that's directly at odds with his previous assertions that he had the ability to write and cash these checks due to his official position. That goes to the question of whether or not he believes he was guilty, but with respect to the materiality, that's a legal determination for this court. Likewise, the legal question of whether somebody with the authority to access an account can even commit bank fraud is a legal question that needs to be resolved by this court before it accepts and affirms his conviction here, Your Honor.
On page 7 of your brief, you talked about basically the memorandum was irrelevant, that he could have, and I think you mentioned it earlier, he could have put whatever down in that memo and they would have still been forced to cash the check. Is that actually your position, that if he would have gone in and said, I'm buying a boat, that they would have been required then to still cash that check?
I think that it's not clear from the record whether they were required to be. What is clear from the record is that that would not affect the status of the check as lawful order paper of the United States of America. They would cash it, I think, because of, you know, I don't want to speculate too much. I mean, I think that they would cash it because it is lawful order paper of the United States. They might say, they might call the authorities and say, hey, this guy just said, he just took out money and he said he's going to go use it to buy a boat, and I think he's committing an embezzlement. And he, to be sure, he might have been caught sooner at that point, I think.
I mean, what would have occurred had they cashed the check? Do you think the government would have accepted responsibility for that loss of funds, or would that have been pushed back to the bank?
I think they would have had to, Your Honor. I mean, just by the stipulation of fact, it asserts that they, you know, they would have to honor, the Air Force would have to honor the check when presented to the Air Force. He had the authority to write the check, and that's really the issue here, is that these weren't fraudulent checks. They were real checks. He had the authority to write them, and he abused his discretion in determining and deciding for his own that he's going to ask for more emergency cash so that he could really take it later. So the issue really is that he was acting under his actual authority, not under the guise of his authority.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is closed.
All right.